Salman Rushdie is best known for his novels Midnight's Children and The Satanic Verses, among others. While those take place in India and the United Kingdom, his latest, The Golden House, is set in New York City, against the backdrop of modern politics from Obama to Trump. The Golden House is a modern epic of love and terrorism, loss and reinvention. Set in a real garden in the real city of New York, where real people are leading real lives with real problems. After a 30-year postponement, the New York State Writers Institute welcomes Salman Rushdie for a presentation and Q&A at 7:30 Thursday night, April 19th at Page Hall on Western Avenue on the University of Albany downtown campus. In September of 2017, I spoke with Salman Rushdie on the book show about The Golden House, and about how he came to write the novel.
You know, I always had the intention of trying to do something a little bit scary, which is to write a novel set in more or less the exact moment that the novel is being written. You're not supposed to do that. I sort of have a tendency to do things I'm not supposed to do. So I thought I'd try that. I mean, I was open to whatever was going to be happening at that time. And then, yes, of course, the election campaign happened, and so that found its way into the book. But you know, for me, that was a kind of the background panorama against which the story plays out. The story itself had developed in my head quite firmly quite a long time before all that.
And that ultimately is the story of this man, a very wealthy man, coming to New York City and that idea of reinventing yourself.
Yeah, the strange thing is that, you know, I had a journalist from Europe come to interview me who showed me an interview that I'd done in the year 2000, in which I had described to the journalist a character very much like Nero Golden that I was thinking about writing about. So strangely, I mean, I'd forgotten that it was that long ago. I knew I'd had him in my head for maybe 8 or 9 years, but I didn't realize it was almost twice as long as that. I'd had this idea of this shady, maybe corrupt, wealthy man who gets involved in very deep waters, gets involved with organized crime and so on, and then wants to get away from it, wants to just step away from that old life and moves halfway across the world, sheds the skin of his old life, changes his name, doesn't want to ever admit where he comes from, and tries to be a new person in New York City. And of course, the reinvention of the self is one of the great themes of American literature, so it was kind of very appropriate that he should come from India to New York to make this effort. But of course, the problem is, I think any reader who begins the book will see pretty early on that this is a man and a family that's concealing something really pretty large and dark, and it's obviously at some point in the novel going to blow up in his face.
He takes up residence in the Gardens, and that's this sheltered, gated community in Greenwich Village in New York. And this is really a bubble, right? This is a place where people are intrigued, but they don't go too far in asking questions.
Exactly. You know, I mean, one of the things that actually I think is attractive about life in a big city is that your neighbors don't really care that much about you. You know, that you just get on with your life and they get on with theirs, and you kind of smile at each other on the sidewalk, but you don't really care about their lives. And very different from life in a small town or in a village where everybody is much more involved in each other's lives. But I think one of the things about the big city is that it is a place where you can live pretty anonymously without anybody bothering too much. The Gardens is this wonderful little space, this sort of communal garden in Greenwich Village, which actually exists, and which I knew about because I had a couple of friends with houses there. And it suddenly struck me that this was a wonderful private space in which the private story of Nero and his family could unfold, while all around it was the large public space of the city in America. So there's a private story literally physically enclosed in the gardens, but surrounded by the public story of the time.
And it's also fascinating to see this character's outside perspective of what the United States is.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I deliberately did was that not only Nero and his family are immigrants to America, But most of the people living around the gardens, the fictional people living around the gardens, are also immigrants of various kinds. There's an Italian family, there's a Burmese diplomat, there's the narrator, René, his parents, who are college professors, are originally from Belgium. And I wanted, quite deliberately, to make a portrait of a sort of immigrant vision of New York.
And that idea is of looking at some of these families and the characters that we read about in the book, that they are trying to shed their history, to shed the place that they came from.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, you know, it's not an unusual attitude of migrants, that they don't want to carry too much of the baggage from the old world. They want to be new people in the new world, you know. And I know of lots of, you know, immigrant families that arrive and literally tell their children not to speak the old country language, but to speak English and to be Americans, you know. And so that sense that you have to be new in the new place, you know, is I think, quite a commonplace feeling of migrants to this country. Well, in the case of the main family in the book, the Golden family, they're doing it because they're trying to conceal something. But many of the others are doing it just in the natural way that immigrants wish to renew themselves.
And that idea of reinvention that you keep on coming back to in the novel, and is it possible to become someone new? That the answer to that question, it is for some characters, it isn't for others.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a novel, it's probably not completely possible. You know, I think, if people have secrets in a novel, they have a tendency to come out. You know, if the past is something they're trying to conceal, then the novel will probably not allow them to conceal it for long. In real life, I think people do manage to make new lives quite satisfactorily. On the streets of New York and the roads of New York, you meet all kinds of people from everywhere in the world who seem to have quite contentedly made new lives over here and left the past behind. So I think in real life, maybe people can do it, but in literature, it's tougher.
Since the last time we spoke, you have become an American citizen. Did that get you thinking about this even more? Because you ultimately, in some way, have a new life.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's really true, you know. I mean, I am now able to say that I'm an American novelist, which I wasn't able to say until, you know, like not even 2 years ago. But I just decided, you know, I've been here with a green card like forever, and I just thought, I'm living here, I'm not planning to leave, and I should really fully belong. And so I went through that process, and it really did make a difference, which was quite surprising, given that by the time I became a citizen, I'd lived here for like 16 years. Mm. But I remember just getting into a cab from downtown, where I'd had to go to, you know, swear the oath and so on, and just going back across Manhattan in very familiar streets, realizing that I felt kind of differently about them, that my relationship to the place had just changed quite radically. And so, yes, that did sharpen my perception of what it is to change, you know, what it is to come from one place to another and to become a citizen of that place. Yeah, so that personal experience, I think, did inform the book.
And since this was also happening as an election was raging, which does come to light in the book as well, do you find yourself even becoming more political and more attuned to what is happening around you politically?
Well, you know, I think the funny thing is that it's impossible not to think about politics every day right now.
Right.
Because there's just so much of it, you know? I mean, I said to somebody the other day, I remember when the biggest news of the day was that, you know, Charlie Sheen was doing cocaine. Now we have like 10, now we have like 10 major crises a day.
Right.
And so it's very difficult not to become engaged. But I also think there is a kind of outrage exhaustion that sets in, that, you know, that when I'm having dinner with my friends, we agree with ourselves that we will not mention the president's name just because we want to enjoy our evening. And I do think that there is that danger, that there's so much pressing down upon people that they want to block it out. And so, yes, I mean, that's the climate in which we live, and that's the climate in which, the book was mostly written before the election, although it was reshaped a little bit and tinkered with a little bit in the months after. But I think one of the things I felt that in the ways in which politics really did affect the book is that I felt it made me turn away, if you like, from magic realism. Because I felt when there's so much untruth around, when there's so much make-believe and fantastication and lies being foisted upon us every day, that maybe novels should, you know, just maybe my novels anyway, should just avoid the flying carpets for a little bit and attempt to tell the truth. You know, paradoxically, maybe it's time for the fiction writers to tell the truth. That's what I felt. And so the book really took the form of something really different from my last several novels, being more or less completely a realistic novel, in which I found myself thinking more about, you know, more about writers like Edith Wharton and Henry James and Stendhal than Garcia Marquez, for example. You know, it's a real shift in my thinking.
And what is fascinating in my reading of the novel is that as you're looking at this truth, that one of the main topics of conversation we're having politically is the telling of the truth.
Exactly. And I mean, the world is turned upside down. The people telling the truth are called fake, and the people calling them fake are the ones not telling the truth. We have a government composed entirely of billionaire elitists who call college professors and journalists and novelists elite. The meaning of words is being inverted, being stood on its head. And it's a very strange time to be, if your job is to do with the meaning of words, if your job is as an artist is to try and create truth and meaning, it's a bewildering time to live in when the most powerful forces in the country are trying to do the opposite.
Salman Rushdie's new book is The Golden House. It is published by Random House. He'll be speaking at 7:30 on Thursday night, April 19th at Page Hall on Western Avenue on the University at Albany downtown campus. The story is told from the perspective of a filmmaker. Tell us a little bit about the narrator and going in that direction and having this character tell us the story.
For me, actually, one of the great delights of the novel was the discovery of the narrator who just blossomed from something which I'd originally conceived of into something much richer, I thought. Initially, I had the most boring idea in the world, which is that he might be a writer. And then I realized I just scolded myself, and I said, you know, that's just a terrible idea. That it would be better if he were literally anything else. It'd be better if he was a dentist, you know, than a writer. And so then I thought, well, who is he really if he's not a writer? And I always knew that I wanted him to be much younger than myself. I wanted him to be a young man and to have a young man's perspective on the world he's living in and on the people he encounters and on the Golden Family. And then at a certain point, I thought, you know, I know quite a lot of young filmmakers in New York, as it happens. And I suddenly thought, well, he could be one of that crowd that's sort of recently out of NYU film school and trying to make a life for himself as a filmmaker. And the moment I thought that, a whole range of possibilities entered the novel, that he could, the work he was doing as a filmmaker would interact with the story of the Goldens. And that freed me up a little bit, and I enjoyed being able to use my lifetime of film nerdery, you know, to put that in his head. Initially, I thought he would be only an observer. I thought he would be a character who's a neighbor of the Golden family who begins to be, you know, to watch them because he thinks they might be a subject that he could make a film about. But I thought he'll be on the outside looking in, and as he finds out little bits of their secrets, so we, the reader, we also find out. But then it became clear to me that he wasn't just going to be an observer, that at some crucial point in the novel, he was going to cross the boundary from being an observer to being a participant in their lives, and that was going to implicate him in all kinds of strange, dark moral decisions. And he was going to have to work his way through that. So he became a protagonist, not just an observer. And I think the book is much better for that. It's become his story as much as the story of the Golden Family.
Do you feel that you perhaps have more experience than most in dark moral decisions?
Yeah, maybe. I think I've had my share of them. Yeah. But not these dark moral decisions. I mean, I've never been involved in, you know, organized crime or murder.
No, of course not.
Not yet.
But that allows you, and I guess I think about, of course, I understand the differences between a filmmaker and a writer, but yet they both still have that gene of observation, don't they? I
mean, yes.
Of looking inward and saying, okay, what is this and how can I tell this story?
Yes, and the fact that he himself does something, I don't want to reveal it, but he does something in the novel which is itself morally compromised, you know, forces him to discuss, to think about right and wrong, good and evil, not just in terms of the family he's investigating, but himself as well. You know, so it becomes personal, not just not just observation.
You do a lot of things that say you shouldn't do in a novel, and one of the things is there are a lot of topical references in the novel. And so this character emerges, a very Trumpian character, about halfway through. And does that help you in a sense of kind of figure it out as it's going on, of batting it back and forth?
Yeah.
Not so much that they are formed an understanding as to what's going on, but a way of trying to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, when I was younger, I used to need a lot of very formal architecture for the novel before I could start to write. And as I've got older, I found myself being able to work in a slightly more free-form way where I can, I mean, almost use improv techniques where I just try things out and respond to things that are happening and incorporate them. And it's a new way of working which I'm enjoying. I did that in the last couple of novels now. As the election campaign, the primaries, and then the election itself developed. And, you know, everybody was thinking and talking about it all year. It would have seemed absurd to ignore it. You know, so the question was how to use it and how to refer to it. And it's the only bit of the novel which slightly diverges from social realism because I just had this idea that, you know, in the same way as kind of Hollywood movies seem to have been taken over by Marvel and DC and to be full of superheroes and supervillains, that it seemed possible that that's what was happening to Washington as well. And so the politicians fighting the election in the book are represented as you know, superheroes and supervillains, as cartoon characters, as grotesques. And I wanted to make this contrast between, as you said in your introduction, you know, real people with their real lives and real problems. But when you rise to the level of power, you suddenly find yourself confronted with grotesques. And that's the kind of perspective the novel offers on what was going on in the election.
As you mentioned of coming to this country now a citizen, but coming to New York in 2000, leaving London, coming to New York.
Yeah.
And being not a superhero nor a supervillain, but being certainly a superstar literary talent, has your path crossed that of Donald Trump in the city of New York?
It has actually a couple of times. I mean, not recently. Not since he began his political odyssey, but way back when I was first here in the early part of the century, yes, I ran into him two or three times. I ran into him improbably at a Crosby, Stills, and Nash concert where he was present with his, of course, then much younger sons and Ivanka, much younger Ivanka, and the two disgusting boys. And it puzzled me, or not puzzled me, but it surprised me that he was on his feet singing along and seemed to know the words to the songs. I wouldn't have guessed that Donald Trump would know the words to Woodstock. This was completely a chance encounter. We just happened to have seats near each other. I've met him a couple of times since then. I mean, he was always very nice to me. You know, he once offered me, right around this time of year when the U.S. Tennis Open was going on, he asked if I liked to go, and I said, yeah, sometimes I did. And he offered me seats in his box. Of course, he felt the need to tell me that it was the best box. That it was better really better than all the other boxes.
Of course.
I didn't take up the invitation.
While we talk about the Trump aspect of the novel, it's also very much an elegy to the Obama administration.
Initially, when I was first thinking of the book, it didn't occur to me that it would be so firmly anchored between the inauguration of Barack Obama and the 2016 election. I had just thought it would, broadly speaking, take place during the years of the Obama administration. It would be an attempt to reflect the reality of that time. But then I began to think that it would be better to be precise about the dates, because I remember the night in 2008 of the first Obama election, and I remember walking around the streets of the city really late at night in places where mostly very young people, but not only young people, had assembled, places like Rockefeller Center and Union Square and so on, and just feeling this incredible force of happiness and optimism that there was that night. And then thinking that from that until 8 years later, there is an arc from that hopefulness to, certainly from my perspective, it's opposite. That journey from hope to, you know, something, and there's a moment at which the narrator, René, feels very close to despair. Mm-hmm. But you know, that journey, I thought, should be part of the emotional journey of the book as well.
Don't you think we're going to see a period where novelists are reacting to this period in time?
I don't know how they'll do it. I mean, I just hope there aren't like 75 novels about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, there's enough Donald Trump already, you know. I mean, already people can hardly have a conversation about anything without it ending up in that direction, in that place. I just think the thing we have to do is to do our job, is to create beauty, you know, to create works of art that enthrall people and that show people things about human nature and about their world and about other people's worlds, and allow people to live in those imagined worlds, do the job of the artist, you know, and I think that's really the thing we have to continue to do.
But even if we take him out of the equation and the novel isn't about him, that world and the place that we live in has still been altered dramatically.
Yes, that's true. And I think that sort of fractured America, you know, I think that's a subject. That's a subject. Much more than the character of the president. The character of the nation, I think that's a subject. And I mean, I'm not exactly clear what to do next, but one voice in my head is saying, you've now written two novels consecutively set in New York City, and maybe it's time to get out of that comfort zone, you know, go somewhere where people don't think like you, and see what's going on, you know. So, and I don't even know at this point if I'll do that, or if I do it, whether it'll be fiction or nonfiction, but I do think that, you know, engaging with this very, in some ways, broken culture. You know, it doesn't feel like E Pluribus Unum right now, you know. It doesn't feel like out of many one people coming together. It feels like there feels that the very deep rift in the country. And you know, I don't believe that everyone who voted for Donald Trump was a white supremacist or a racist. There was real anger in parts of the country and a feeling of being neglected and not heard and not benefiting from the economic revivals of the Obama years and so on. I think, you know, there are decent people trying to express that anger. And I think one has to get out there and listen. You know, you have to get out there and listen and respond. I mean, I have a very short attention span for racists, so I'm not that interested in that, but I am interested in finding out the larger story of what's happening in the country.
Salman Rushdie's new book is The Golden House. It is published by Random House. Salman Rushdie will be giving a craft talk at 4:15 at the Lecture Center on the Uptown campus of the University at Albany on Thursday, April 19th. Later that day at 7:30 at Page Hall on Western Avenue on the downtown campus, he'll be giving a presentation and a Q&A. Both events are free and open to the public. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.